Good morning, everyone. Welcome. I see a couple of heads back there doing this, and so I am going to try to try my best to keep you awake. Is everybody having a good time so far? Good. And every time I get up here, I look out and I see all these different faces, and I think I've seen everybody, and I've never seen you before. And so, when I proposed this idea in 2006, it was to bring together friends and everybody network and to chat and get to know each other. So if I haven't seen you and you see me walking around somewhere, please come by and say hi, because that's really the essence of what I've been doing for 20 years. And it's really one of the reasons why I put this thing together every 20 years. I don't put it together every 20 years, put it together every year.
But,
that's nice. You don't know what I have in this.
Well, it's not working fast enough.
No, it's not, or it's going in the wrong direction, or one of something, I don't know. But as I was getting ready this morning, I was thinking, what time? Caitlin Rother is from San Diego, and I was thinking, what time is it there? So she's like doing a 6 o'clock interview here with us. So.
And I got up at 3:30. Not this time, San Diego time.
Yeah. And she got up at 3:30 because she's thinking, my God, I got to talk to him at 8 o'clock, and I don't know what we're going to talk about.
Pretty much. Then I looked in the mirror, I'm like, I got to wash my hair. Anyway.
So, Caitlin has got a history in, she's a journalist and an investigative journalist. And that transferred over into true crime. And how many true crime books do you
have? A dozen.
A dozen? An even dozen? Or Baker's dozen?
Yep, pretty much.
Even dozen.
12, yep.
An even dozen. Okay, and so she's got an even dozen. Didn't they make a film like that, Brad?
Is that Dirty Dozen?
Yeah, so she's got an even dozen and is now... Just because she has some extra time, she's moving over into writing thrillers as well as true crime. So what I want to look at here, because I think sometimes as writers, we have a lot of information that we want to get into our books. And I just looked at what goes into Caitlin's books, and it's like there's a ton of unorganized, messed up information everywhere. That's just, I mean, it's easy.
Not in my book, but that
your books are. Your books are great. I was going to talk to you about page 145 on this one, though. I'm kidding.
Okay.
But no, it's. I'm just thinking how I think, and those who know me, is I'm like, you know, my brain is an electron. It's doing this all the time. It's not going where it needs to go. So I want to talk a little bit about that. And so if you are not a true crime writer, take some of the things that we are talking about here and apply it to the messy job that you've got going. And if you don't have a messy job with what you've got going, I'd love to talk to you, because I've been doing this for years and I haven't figured it out. So, Caitlin, how do you take all of that chaos? And there are reams and reams of, you know, you've got more papers probably than congressional reports, right? So how do you start organizing all of that into something? And tell me even like any kind of like apps or anything you use to help to organize all of this madness. You keep it all in your head? Oh, my Lord. I need to bow.
Well, which is why I can't remember anything. My short-term memory ends up getting filled up. So by the time I get to the end of a book, I've got brain sieve syndrome because it's so full. And when I'm trying to work on more than one book at a time, this past year I've been ending up working on 4 thrillers at once while I'm promoting 2 true crime books, and it's been really tricky. So when I start a true crime book, I have nothing. Honestly, I have what's been in the newspaper, and if you've noticed, the fabulous shrinking newspaper industry is basically almost, I won't say it's non-existent, but compared to when I started out, my first book came out in 2005. So I was actually still a newspaper reporter on staff at that point, and I actually covered a trial. And so I covered this case from arrest to sentencing, which is something that I haven't been able to duplicate since because my newspaper did not want me really to write another book because unlike the Washington Post, which takes pride in having its journalists write books and take time off, my newspaper was trying to keep me away from anything that might turn into a book because I, for some reason, didn't like that. So I basically had to take time off. I wasn't allowed to do anything to pursue a book until I had finished covering it. For ethical reasons, because I might hold things back or I might overcover it to get more publicity for my book. You know, these are the things that editors spend their time worrying about. So in that case, I had everything as I was reporting, I was gathering material, and then afterwards, you get more. If you're good with sources, they trust you, they'll help you and give you things. That has changed over the years significantly to the point where people don't want to talk, they don't want to cooperate, they don't want to talk to you unless you pay them, which I don't do. But so it depends on the book and it's depending on the time when I started the book. And like I said, over time it's become more and more difficult. So just to give you a comparison, in that case I had all this stuff. One of the first things that I do once the trial is over is I get to go to the exhibit room and copy and review it. You have to get a court order to do that. So the judge has to, this judge, I got to know him and he played in a band. I went to go see him in his band and that was fun. But in court, you know, he's very. So I went in there and copied all this stuff with my friend of mine who worked at the paper and was super nice and helped me with my first few books, took professional photos, which I was then able to use in the book. That's the other thing, is the photo insert. It takes almost as much time as the book itself because you got to get permission, which is a whole other thing. So I'd gather all this stuff, I'd read through it, and then I would do interviews. And in that case, I only had a couple police interviews that I had access to, both in video and transcripts. So I basically just get everything I possibly can. Like you were saying about your brain, that's kind of what I'm doing. I'm gathering, gathering, gathering. So to give you a contrast, my most recent book, Down to the Bone, was totally the opposite. I couldn't go to the trial because it was 6 hours away if I had driven there every day, which was impossible. Law and Crime was trying to televise it live, but the reception was so bad that they kept losing the signal, so I tried to follow it, and I ended up kind of, you know, looking on Twitter for live feed, you know, to see what was going on. And I eventually, though, they would post 225 excerpts of the trial, so that became a source as well. But then I find out that wasn't a complete, so I was missing pieces. So like half part of the defense's opening statement was missing, which was kind of important. So after that, I went and got what was physically available publicly. So I would go to every courthouse that these people, this is the McStay family, Family of Four, who went missing mysteriously in 2010. The San Diego County Sheriff's Department investigated it as a missing persons case, which they came heavily under criticism for because they gave up, said they voluntarily went to Mexico. 9 months later, their skeletal remains were found in 2 shallow graves in the desert where they had been the entire time. So I tried to look for news articles. There really weren't many because, again, the fabulous shrinking media, it started out getting heavy coverage, but as the media shrunk over time, it took 9 years to get going to trial. I went to the preliminary hearing. I took my own photos whenever I could. I always try to be part of the photo pool so I get access to photos. That's a secret. Nobody does it except me. But then if there's no photographer, then you have to be the pool photographer, so you better be ready. So I gathered my own material, and I went to courthouses everywhere, and a lot of people in this case had criminal records or civil records, so that was fun. Then again, I did the court order thing, got the exhibits. There were 1,200 exhibits, massive amounts of paper. It took me 5 days. I bring my own copy machine, plug it in, and copied everything. Okay, so then I get it home, and then I can read through it. So that was great, and it felt really good. I wrote about 90,000 words. I interviewed the lead detective for the second agency in San Bernardino County that investigated it as a homicide. San Diego County refused to talk to me because they got it wrong, and they were embarrassed, I think, and didn't want to look bad, but they still look bad anyway. So I got no cooperation from them, limited cooperation. But, you know, at least they talked to me. So the family did not want to talk to me at all because they had already been criticized for things they had said to the media. And also when they testified, they didn't look so good, the stuff that came out. So I had very limited cooperation in this case. And so what I ended up having to do was basically write a book mostly from documents, which is not as compelling. You can't get the emotion that, you know, that you want to get because you can't say, how did this affect you? But what I do is I get everything I can from whatever they've already said to the media, on TV documentaries, in testimony, and witness interviews, if I can get them. At that point, I didn't really have any. So I've written an entire book, 90,000 words, 4 months before my deadline. I finally, after 12 years, get the discovery materials I've been trying to get. Huge treasure trove of stuff. All the investigative reports from all the detectives, what they were thinking, what they were looking for, what they found, what they didn't find, who they were looking at, who they weren't looking at, and I was able to basically lay all that out. And that was not public material. That is not something you can get with a public records request. You have to get it from somebody who works, who's a party to the case. I was able to get that from both sheriff's departments, and so this is stuff that they did not want revealed, had never been revealed publicly. And so that was also difficult when it came to the legal vetting from my book, because the safe thing these days is, did this come out in court or did this come out publicly? Has this been in the newspaper before? No. That's the reason I'm writing this book, is because the media really wasn't covering this trial. There was no one there. It was a 6-month trial. So basically, I had to rewrite pretty much the whole book. And I added, so I wrote a book and a half, essentially, and then I had to cut it all in 4 months. And this was thousands and thousands and thousands of pages that I had to read, process, pull little pieces, weave it through what I'd already written, throw out stuff that was not as good as the new stuff. And then I turned to my book and was pretty much lay around for 3 months recovering. I know that's a very long answer, but I wanted to give you a contrast of what it was like when I started versus what it's like today. It's just a very different, very, very different landscape.
So how did you get this information that you can't get?
That I can't tell you, or I'd have to kill you.
Okay. Okay.
Of course.
I would assume some undisclosed source.
Yes.
It was, you found it in the train station, and no one claimed
it. No, I got it legally. It just took a very long time, and this person had to trust me, and I thought I was going to get it from somewhere else, and they said they were going to help, and then they didn't, and da-da-da-da.
So. Well, I hope I'm not overstepping my bounds. I was reading this book, and I'm like, these guys are like idiots. and I said, you can't be very well liked because of the portrayal of.
I just write it straight.
You just wrote it straight, but it was like. I find evidence at your house that you probably killed the person, but you say that you were doing something else. I'm making this up, but you say you're doing something else, so I don't need a search warrant. And so then somebody goes in and cleans it all up and gets rid of all the evidence. And I mean, it's just stuff like that, but this went on for like 2 years or something, or it seemed like when that they were investigating that.
4 years, yeah.
4 years, okay. All right. How do you decide what is going to be that opening image for you when you're writing a book like this?
Well, when I'm putting a proposal together, that's very important. I take a lot of time with my proposals, so I do a lot of research up front. And in this case, like I said, I had already written a whole proposal. I'd written pretty much a whole book when I got all this new material. So you can't anticipate that, and you're going to end up rewriting things to make it better. You have to submit a sample chapter with your proposal. I usually try to start with the beginning of the book just because I think that's going to be the most compelling for an editor who wants to buy it, as same with a reader. And it's not necessarily what's going to be published. But I think I pretty much had this idea from the beginning to open with the child's skull that was found in the desert sitting on a rock by a motorcyclist who was driving around, because that's when everything changed. So this was a missing persons case. The San Diego County Sheriff's Department detective had pretty much been thinking along these lines since the beginning, that they had voluntarily gone to Mexico, which was never the case. And so the moment this whole case changed was when that motorcyclist found this piece of skull sitting out there in the desert. And so I just, you know, a couple pages lead people in. So I have essentially, though, had to have two beginnings to the story. So that was the prologue. And there are some people who say, I don't read prologues, which I don't understand, because to me, that's a really important flash of something compelling that makes you want to read the book. So at least mine are. I don't know. At least I try to write them that way. And then chapter one, I go back to the very beginning where this family just mysteriously disappeared and what their house looked like before Joseph McStay, who's the father, Summer McStay was the mother, and there were two little boys, 3 and 4 years old, before Joseph's mother came in and, as Clay was mentioning, came in and cleaned up the entire scene before the police did a proper search and served a search warrant. So everything, the entire scene was completely irrevocably altered, so which was just a mess. And she didn't do it on purpose to mess things up. Nobody told her not to.
They even repainted part of the house to cover up the bloodstains.
The blood that was never there, that they could never find.
Yeah, the blood they can't find.
These victims were found with holes in the back of their skulls. And if you know anything about head wounds, you know, the skull bleeds a lot. And if you're going to have, they think it's a sledgehammer, in the back of the head, you're going to have a lot of spatter. It's going to go everywhere. They did not find a single drop of blood in the house, and yet the Sheriff's Department in San Bernardino County, which took over the second phase of the investigation, insisted that these murders happened in the house. So basically, the book is all about the allegations of confirmation bias, which is basically when you have a piece of evidence or a premise at the beginning and you just won't move no matter what else you find that contradicts that.
Yeah, and I think for those of you who write fiction, which I think is probably a good number of the people in the room, it's a really good, these books, I haven't read a whole lot of true crime where some of the inefficiencies of the law enforcement are portrayed as accurately as you have portrayed some. And let me say that she portrays the good ones well, but she's also honest and portrays the other ones honestly. And she didn't make judgment in the book. You just sit and read and go, what? As you're going along. But this case she's talking about, the sledgehammer. I mean, these were like little kids, and they weren't hit just once. They were hit like four times or something.
Six or seven times.
Six or seven times, okay.
Just unbelievable.
What do you call this? You keep correcting me, all these things about facts. Facts must be something important to you. I'm not sure what that is. I count to four, and I'm like, no, I'm kidding.
Well,
I'm just jerking your chain.
They vary depending on the victim, yes.
So we always talk about, we don't dump all this backstory into your novel, right? Because it slows it down. We got to get our forward motion going, right? Everything you've got's backstory. So how do you keep the forward motion going when what you're dealing with his backstory?
Well, I always want to advance the story with my book. So there are people who are out in the community and they're like, oh, I already know that story. I saw a TV documentary about it. TV documentary is generally based on news stories that they've read, or if there's a book out, they'll often base it on that. This is not public knowledge. I don't think this is being publicized anywhere else, but 2020 is doing a story on this case. And they said they wanted to interview me. They asked for 4 advance copies of the book before it even came out. And I thought we were all set. And then they said they didn't want to pay me, which they had previously done on 2 other occasions. And then after I agreed, after thinking about it, since they have, you know, 3 million viewers, I thought that would be good exposure. I'll just do it anyway. Then they canceled the interview. So they had access to my book for the show, and I got nothing. So that's just...
smarmy.
Yeah, it was really not... Didn't sit well with me. Anyway, but my point is, that's what happens on TV documentaries, and so people think they know everything because they've seen something on TV. Usually, you know, that's not the case. But what was your question?
With all this backstory, how do you move it forward?
Yeah. So when I write a book, I mean, I want it to be compelling, and I want to give people information they don't already have. So I always try to think, what can I tell them that they don't already know? Or if there's things that they do know, I bring in all this new information that I've gathered to give it more context so that they see, oh, I only knew this little piece. And so I paint a much more comprehensive picture and slowly unravel, you know, the backstory as I'm just basically trying to have it move forward, you know, by giving it to a point of view to the detective as he's walking through the house, for example, if I can. I mean, it's tricky. If they don't want to be interviewed, okay, well, then I go through the investigative reports, and that's where he wrote down what he was thinking. Or there's a search warrant affidavit, which also says what he's thinking. And then I go to his testimony, and whatever he says, I know what he's thinking, or at least what he says he was thinking. So even if he never talks to me, I can still tell that story. It just takes a lot of work to try to recraft that. So I'm always wanting to roll out new information as I'm chronologically moving forward with the story. So I'm weaving in the backstory as opposed to just giving you a glop of backstory, because that way you're learning new things as you're recognizing things you already know.
Yeah, and you are very... I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. You know, most of us just kind of make up it as we go along, and you really can't do that.
No, you can't do that in true crime because it's truth. You know, I'm telling the truth. And what I'm trying to do is tell you things you didn't know and things that are juicy tidbits that the sheriff's department doesn't want you to know, things that they did that you're just, you know, I do these book signings, and I go through some of the evidence, some of the discrepancies in the investigation, and also when it gets to trial and the things that the prosecution presented and how they presented and these giant holes and discrepancies and conflicts. And it really is satisfying to me when I just see the whole group of the people in the audience going, I can't believe that, I can't believe that. So that's what I'm going for.
Does this whole process just make you really tired?
Well, that's why I'm writing thrillers now, because it's really fun.
It's easier to make up. You don't have to answer to anyone.
And not so stressful.
Betting is not so bad.
Don't have people fighting me, people not calling me back, being worried that one of the people in the book is going to sue me or hack my computer or break into my house or, you know.
Or show up with a sledgehammer.
Or show up with a sledgehammer. Yeah.
Yeah, because in this book, everybody knows the case if they know the case, right? So is it?
But they don't know it the way that I presented it because that has not been. And it's
okay. Well, I'm not going to go.
They're not going to do it on 2020 either because they told me that they are going to go based on what the jury decided, and I'm challenging the verdict with what I'm showing you, and they apparently are not going to do that. So I'm actually not as upset about it because I don't think they're going to tell the whole truth.
Yeah.
Honestly.
You're one of the few true crime authors that leave things more ambiguous at the end then, and how do you make that satisfying to the reader that wants like some solid closure? And I had the pleasure of having dinner with our guests of honor last night, and I got to sit by Caitlin, and we were talking, and I was like, so I think, you know, because I'm expert on this, I think this person did it, and you still would not commit to what you were. I mean, you got it in your head, right?
Okay, so
because my next question is, okay, you just don't want to tell me what you think, right? But you got it in your head.
I'm going to answer your question.
Okay.
So the last two books that I've written are ambiguous at the end, because both of them were investigated by the same homicide unit in the same sheriff's department, who clearly has issues. So they didn't do a proper investigation. They did not investigate things they should have. They did not ask the questions they should have. They did not gather certain evidence that they should have. So, and when they talked to people, they just believed them instead of, you know, confronting them. And there's just so many issues from top to bottom. Both of the books, Death on Ocean Boulevard, which is the Rebecca Zahau case, where this woman was found hanging naked, bound, and gagged in the rear courtyard of the Spreckles mansion in Coronado, California, within 4 days, because I also got their sheriff's reports and witness interviews, and I could tell from the questions they were asking and who they were talking to, they pretty much admitted that they had decided within about 4 days that this was a suicide.
And even her hands were tied, in case you missed that one.
Tied, hands tied to, bound together, ankles bound together, hands behind her back, and then a T-shirt wrapped around her mouth at three times, and she was gagged, and she somehow magically propelled herself on her toes.
Well, she magically got the thing around her neck, too.
Yeah, magically propelled herself over this iron railing, leaving only a couple toe prints and in the dust. And somehow knew how much rope to cut so that she would fall 9 feet and 2 inches without hitting the ground. But anyway, so the sheriff's department waited 2 months to announce the suicide ruling. They will not move from it. The family thinks she was murdered. They went to court, got a civil jury to agree that they thought it was murder as well. Sheriff's department still will not move. So I don't take a position, because I don't feel like that's really a good idea, even if I really know the answer, but I don't. So for these two cases, I have not taken a position because I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
I feel like there's still too many unanswered questions. And I don't feel like even if I did know, I've always operated this way because I'm a trained journalist to be objective. I've always operated that way. We had a punitive kind of environment that I worked in, that you were never allowed to talk about your opinion if you were interviewed on the radio or TV, and you'd get in trouble if you did. And it's sort of just ingrained in me to just not do it. So people get frustrated with me sometimes, but overall, I think most readers appreciate it, and they tell me that they like the fact that I don't put my opinion in there. I just lay it out for you to decide. And trust me, I'm very aware of what I'm showing you and what I think this is what I think without saying what I think, because I'm illustrating for you all these problems. So you can see it for yourself. I don't need to tell you.
Yeah. And I think it's good when you're, you know, it's almost cliche, but the stories are there all the time. You got the so-and-so agent going into a town and then finding, you know, resistance to them being there, and there's, you know, mishandling of the case and trying to figure it out. Reading her books, if you want to do some research on how that actually works in real life, it's, excuse me, it's there. It's just amazing to me that, I always, in 2006, I always wanted to make sure we portrayed law enforcement accurately. And most of law enforcement is doing a great job in what they're doing. But occasionally you come up to a couple of these clowns, and they are you know, you see people jumping off all bound and everything and immediately assume it's suicide and not change it. And then you, in another book, this one here, you go, get a guy and he just gets railroaded, I think, railroaded into being guilty and, with incompetence in his legal defense. Of course, they let him try to defend himself in this case as well. And I'm like, this is just crazy. This guy's not qualified to defend himself. And then, his attorneys like seem to be on a revolving door at a hotel. They come, they go, and there's no consistency. And then he's got the death penalty and he's not even guilty in my opinion. So it's just like, there's a lot of material in here for if you want to be, you know, if you want to write, those kind of conflicts in your regular thing, it's full in there and it portrays that, you know, that small town police department that's not necessarily doing their job the best way and the FBI agent has to come in and deal with it or something. I mean, you can get great source material from these books, so.
I do want to add, I have another book called Lost Girls, which covers the same San Diego County Sheriff's Department and their homicide unit where they did a really good job. And so that book was very positive about the sheriff's department. So, and the sheriff's department cooperated with me and everything was good. I have another book, two books. Well, one of them showed the flaws because, you know, I just call it like I see it. I'm not trying to protect anybody. I'm not trying to expose anybody. It's just whatever happens is what I write. There's another book called Dead Reckoning about the Newport Police Department. They did a really good job on that case too. So it's not like every book I write is critical of law enforcement. I actually, most of my books were not critical of law enforcement because it seemed much more cut and dried and much, to me, I wasn't questioning the verdict and I wasn't questioning what the prosecution was presenting. But this case, both of these cases were different.
I have so much that I want to ask you, and then Jeffrey's coming in doing his little five-minute thing, letting me know that, can you believe we've talked for 40
no,
minutes?
No, because I could talk 40, about this forever. But.
40 minutes. Yeah. For our fiction writers out here, and you're doing fiction, and you've got four fiction books now that your manuscripts you're working.
I got two under contract that are coming out next year. I just turned in number three with a synopsis for number four that are already written, and now I'm trying to. It's a series, so I want to keep the series going, and I'm hoping that my editor will buy them.
So from true crime to nonfiction, what advice can you give the people in here that they could take from true crime and apply it to make their work more accurate?
I started out wanting to be a crime novelist. So my true crime is narrative nonfiction, so it actually reads like a novel most of the time is when I can. You can't write everything into a scene because sometimes you just, like I said, I can't interview somebody and I don't have that emotion and that perspective. That intimate perspective, sometimes I can't do that. But in most cases, I try to make it novelistic. So I basically tried to get my first mystery novel published. It took me 17 years. It's called Naked Addiction. I wanted to make that into a series. It took me another 17 years to get Hooked published. So what my advice is, I didn't know what I was doing. So I didn't have the material. Now I have the material because I've written 12 true crime books. Now I know how detectives talk and how they think and what they do and what the protocols are and what the order is that they investigate. And that's what I needed to learn. So my books as true crime are pretty, they lay everything out and not in a way, I don't want to bore the reader. I don't want people to skip over chunks. You know, I want to make it interesting. So I don't put in every little detail because that gets boring. But they're really good primers for people who are writing fiction to learn about the criminal justice system, how it works, what the order of things are, how detectives work with prosecution, with prosecutors, and at what point, when do they work together, and it varies. So I just really find that doing the work really helped me learn how to write a good thriller. And I didn't know that when I wrote my first book. So I think the same goes, you can learn too by reading my true crime book so that your fiction will be more informed.
Yeah, and all three of these books are great, so I recommend all three of them. And again, the Guest of Honor books that we're selling do support our scholarship program. So I would love, you know, to sell out of these. So if you guys have an interest in that, please purchase. We'll be in the signing in a little bit. I don't think there's a signing right after this, but
I have another panel, and then I'll be there.
And then we'll be in that. As I read that, I was reminded how back years ago, I was using true crime as a resource mm-hmm. of learning
right.
procedurals.
Yep.
And I really think that that's a great tool for fiction writers is to read a lot of, you know, true crime, and you certainly are portraying it in the subjects that you choose. I think illuminate areas that other necessarily true crime writers don't, because they go for the closure, they go for the non-ambiguity, they choose those stories.
You just need to read my other books; they all have closure. These two don't.
No, but the way you write, though, it reads like a novel.
That's what I try to do.
You don't know where it's going. So anyway, thank you. You guys have a wonderful day, and thank you, Caitlin.
Thank you.